Welcome to the Male Models Podcast. My name is Josh Peck. I'm triple vax and triple patriot. You, Joe?
Are you triple?
I guess, because I'm boosted.
My boosted didn't come up on my app, so technically I'm like nothing.
Are you going to get a quad boost?
Yeah, why not? Load me up.
I'm done with the boost.
I'm getting everyone.
Hey, we have a guest.
Do we?
A very good friend of mine whose last name I know and know how to pronounce, but I'm so in fear now being face to eyes with him that I'm just going to say my good friend, famous director Jay.
You have to try to pronounce it now.
Chandrasekhar.
Well, you're actually pretty close.
Thank you.
In America, they say Chandrasekhar. But I was in India with my father, and he was he went to medical school there, and he ran into one of his friends from medical school, and he came up to him. He goes, "Chandrasekhar, old man, how the hell are you?" And I'm like, "Chandrasekhar?" And he goes, "Yeah, that's how you pronounce her name." I was like, "Whoa,
what were you saying up until
Chandrasekhar?"
The Americanized, just butchered.
I mean, version. yeah, exactly.
Wow,
I get called all sorts of stuff, but it's all. Fun, like Chaka Cocksucker was my nickname at Colgate. Not by a lot of people, three or four.
Sure.
You know, Chandala whatever. You know, some good friends of mine were calling me that for a while.
Is that, even though you have a good laugh about it now, is there any like deep seeds planted where if someone does mess it up, you do want to go for their throat?
No.
No?
It's 13 letters. you have to be an honest person about this. When I look at a Polish last name, and I did a lot because I was in Chicago, you're like, I don't even know where to begin. I still struggle with the Vietnamese name Nguyen.
Gwen.
I say Nguyen.
Nguyen. I think so, it's Gwen.
Okay, so it's Gwen. Okay, there you go. So what, does that make me a bad guy?
Not at all.
No.
Did you play sports?
I played football in high school for a week.
Could they fit your name on the jersey?
I didn't get it. I didn't get to the jersey part. I quit. I was the fastest guy on the team, and the coach was really upset. I thought I was going to be the first Indian running back in the NFL. Job still available. But the coach was like, you know, don't quit. I'm like, yeah, I'm quitting. I mean, the physical violence. I played a lot of like in the backyards football, and I was, you know, I had no problem with that kind of tackling, but once you put pads and helmets on, I was like, I don't know. I mean, and it was also at a time when you were meant to be super tough, like we were doing two a days in August in Chicago, and so it's like 100 degrees, and you're sweating, you lose 8-10 pounds every first practice, and then you eat, and then you lose another 8-10 pounds, and the water break was a hose, right? And you line up for this hose. And this lineman coach, who I wasn't on the line, had a wiffle ball bat. And he would go and bash everybody in the head with a wiffle ball bat. And he would, at water break, he'd go, "My linemen don't need water." And you're like, you guys.
Wow.
And they would stand there sadly while we drank from the hose.
Jay, you're an incredibly famous director.
Thank you.
You and I have worked together.
Yes.
Did you know that, Joe?
No. Yeah. Where? What movie?
He directed a pilot I was in. # didn't get picked up.
Not because of us, though.
I hope not.
I don't know.
So easy softball question. What do you think of me as an actor? Joe, be quiet.
Do you have to throw a lot of notes his way?
No. You're he's a real pro. I mean, the key for those who are trying to make it is this. Show up on time and know your lines. And then, you know, if you look right, which he does, it's hard to replace him because you're like, and then you end up kind of doing things and becoming famous. And you're like, well, it's sort of like, you know, I've worked with Rob Lowe quite a few times. And he's like, he goes, because I was just talking about The West Wing. And he goes, it was 7 stone cold killers. We all showed up on time. We all knew our lines. And you're like, it's a low bar, really, but I've had actors. I did a thing with Brooke Shields and this new actor, and I wanted to do a walk and talk. It was 2 pages of dialogue, and immediately I'm like, this kid doesn't know even a single line.
And I know it's literal, but tell the people what a walk and talk is, just in case they don't.
It means that you put the cameras on like a Steadicam, and you're in front of the actors, and a Steadicam is a moving camera. And the actors just walk and they say their lines while the camera's moving. And so you have to know your lines. And when one actor finishes, the other one starts and the other one finishes. And so you have to know your lines. And this guy didn't know any of his lines. And I'm doing take after take. And I knew he wasn't going to get it on take 13. I was just punishing him. And I told him, I said, there's a reason this is happening. And it's because you don't know your lines. And look who you're with. You're with Brooke Shields. I said, that shall never happen again for you. And if it does, you got to get a new job. And I told him that because I'm like, let this sear into your brain. I said, now we're going to stop. I'm going to reblock the scene where you're standing there and I'll shoot Brookside first so you can learn your lines off screen. And then we flip around, you'll probably know your lines. I said, but you've changed the way I'm blocking the set. And I wasn't mean. I just said, this is what's going on. And I know, wow. I know you probably look at your show and go, oh, I'm really good. Actors always do that. Even the ones who can't remember their lines, because I cut them in the right rhythm. And they're like, hey, I'm pretty good. This system I'm doing is pretty good. It's not. And the second I can do a new show, and I'm like, should I hire Josh Peck or this other guy who doesn't know his lines? Well, guess who's getting the job?
That's interesting, because I don't even like myself after editing.
Well, nobody likes themselves. I mean, the few sickos like themselves watching themselves. I can't stand watching myself.
Which is interesting, because you've had to self-direct a lot of stuff.
It was the only way I could get myself into the movies and television. Mm. I had to learn how to write and direct, because otherwise I didn't think I would get cast. I mean, and the truth was, the evidence when I started was that when they wanted an Indian guy, they put a white guy in brownface, right, like Fisher Stevens in Circuit 2,
right?
In the movie The Party with the great I'll think of it anyway.
Hank Azaria, Simpsons.
Yeah, and by the way, I thought Hank Azaria was hilarious.
Yeah,
and I thought, you know, my dad saw Short Circuit 2, and he said, "You have to see Short Circuit." And I'm like, why? He goes, there's an Indian in it. And I'm like, that's not a real Indian. He goes, well, it's as close as we'll get. Yeah. And I'm like, no, it's not. I'm going to go on this. I mean, you know, a lot of my career is like a revenge mission. It's like, yeah, I'll show them.
Well, know, that starts with women, right? For guys like us, it's uh-huh, like, uh-huh, I'll show those girls who said no to me
that's
how,
right,
how damn attractive and powerful I can
that's
be.
That's right.
Right, that's Joe? Joe, I know you get it.
It's 100% true.
Yeah.
It's 100% true. And some of my greatest, and look, this happened to me twice. Like, there were women that I pursued in college that were like blazing hot. And by the way, I did really well in college. But these two women, I pursued them and I couldn't quite land it. And we were such close friends. And, you know, with Indian guys, you have to be friends for like weeks and then finally they'll make out with you. Oh, okay. And with these two, I just went, and both of them, after we graduated, made moves on me at bars and said, let's go. And I'm like, sorry. And I turned two of them down.
Woo!
And
for us.
And it's my greatest regret. But I also am glad I did it. But it still kills me that I didn't do that.
You ever turn anyone down, Joe?
I've never had the opportunity.
I have. I turned out someone super famous.
Who?
Well, I can't.
Whisper it. I'll cut it out.
I'll say it. Cut it out. Bleep okay. it. Heard of her?
What?
Yeah, like done some stuff, but you never heard of him. You know, it's funny, before we like, and I think this honestly speaks to me and my insecurities. When we made our pilot together, I was 25.
So yeah.
Nine, almost 10 years ago. Uh-huh. I was convinced you didn't like me while filming. And I think, I would tell you this, I think it's a good personality trait in a director that your level of cool, kind of just go with the flow, non-reactive, which you really don't want. You don't want big swings from your director. Uh-huh. You want them just kind of keeping the pace. I just remember, I remember distinctly, we ended my last shot of that show that we made. It was a show called The Rebels for Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was like this walk and talk. And granted, it's a pilot, right? So the stakes feel high because you know we're all trying to prove ourselves. But you've probably spent 7 days shooting the show. It's not exactly a marathon. It's quick.
Yeah.
And I remember we do that scene and you go, yeah, great. And then you just kind of walked off. I'm like, that's it? We're done? Where's my hug? And I think it's just like now I'd be like, yeah, fine. I know. I feel good about it. Jay was a nice guy, had good notes, and that would be it. But I know then I would, oh God.
I would consider that my behavior malpractice because actors, I'm one of them, run, all creative people run on compliments. Mm. And, you know, this town is full of creative people who need to know. I mean, by the way, I have a camera on you and we're close and we're looking at you and you're saying words and you're trying to be funny and you should hear what I think of it. Mm. And I'd be shocked if I didn't say, good job, you did great. But you're saying I didn't, which is shocking to me because
really?
I am a compliment machine. I mean, I am like, I will look at the dolly grip. I'm like, I love the push on that dolly right there. Or I'll go to the gaffer. I'm like, how about that lighting? Dappled, you know?
Yeah, craft service.
Because
I've never seen a spread like this.
Well, yes, because everybody has their little fiefdom. And when the boss compliments them, they go, well, I like that guy.
Yeah.
And when the producer comes down, which they inevitably do, and they go, what do you think of this director? They go, well, I like that guy.
Right.
He just told me I had a good dolly move. And the truth is, the dolly move was good. And the craft service is good. And the lighting is good. And me not saying it, all it does is have them go, oh, I wonder if he likes it.
Right.
You know, a lot of directors will tell me, well, you know if I like it by if we move on. And I'm like, that's the most aggressive thing you can do. I mean, you know, when I'm acting and I deliver my lines well and I'm like, I nail it. And the director just moves on. I'm like, what happened? Did he not like it? But I know enough to know that he's one of those directors or she's one of those directors who moves on. I like it when they come up and go, wow, that was great. I love it. You should act more. Wow. I didn't know you were that tall. Well, you know, whatever. You know, whatever it is. I want to hear it. You'll go further in this career if you show up on time, know your lines, and you throw out compliments.
I mean, I'm so cynical now. Not applying to someone of your stature, but where I'll do some TV show with some director, and they'll be like, "That was unreal," and I'll be like, "The fuck do you know?" Like, I'm literally, like in my head, I'll just be like, "Yeah, who cares? You're not going to pick a good take." Or I worry more of like when they're so not so hyped, but they're just like, "Please," or I'm like. I don't know. Like, because then I feel like I'm running my performance. And if that's the case, we know we're in trouble.
Well, that's true. And that's why the compliments, and I teach a lot of people how to direct. Like, mm-hmm. I have, you know, shadows, they're called. And they watch me while I direct television, and I just kind of, I teach them. And I tell them, you have to be a compliment machine, but they have to be very honest compliments. They should be specific. I like the way you slowed down after that one line and then you ramped it back up again. I like that look you threw over there before you delivered that punchline. Mm-hmm. Just super specific stuff that's not, great job, I love it, wow, way to go. Like, it was just, it's important because, of course, you have a great bullshit detector. Right. I do too. You know, and so I want to, you know, if you specify the compliment, then the people with the bullshit detector can't detect it.
And how do you phrase it when it's not working?
Well, we have to keep going, you know? Like,
you do so much TV, and that's especially...
Everything I do has to be great, or else it looks bad on me. And I can tell you this, we're not leaving with it looking bad on me. So we're going to make it great. And if we have to, we're going to make it really good. And that may mean just read it the way I'm telling you right now. Read it exactly the way I'm telling you. And it'll be great. And after this word, look left and then look right and then say the word again. When they do it, I'm like, yeah, that will fit into the puzzle of this show and it's going to work. And I know, right? Because I've done 150 episodes of television, 9 movies. You know, like I'm, eventually you get pretty good at it.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Wow.
Do you prefer to do TV over film?
No, it's just that I don't have to do any of the setup work on television. Like, you know, with films, I got to go out and raise the financing sometimes, or I got to go to the studios and convince them they want, you know, to give me money. And that's really hard to get a studio to give you money to make a movie. I've done it, and often it's sort of you have to wait for them to call you and say, we want to make a movie with you. And we go, oh, well, it's this movie. And then they'll do it. But if you walk in there and say, hey, I want you to make this movie, they're like, well, let's develop it for 2 years and then let's put it on a shelf. That's usually what happens. So I always keep my movies, you know, in control. I control them so that I can raise money on my own. And then I can go to them and go, hey, I already have $5 million here. You want to put the other five in and then we'll make it? And they go, oh, okay. You know, and they, you know, they, because they need movies. They still need movies. But if they're, if it doesn't cost as much to them to make it, they're like, oh, okay. Yeah. Well, you know, you have to kind of, you know, I bring money so that I don't, I'm not just with a, holding a piece of paper. You know, right. A script is just 120 pages. And you're like, they got thousands of those.
How is the process of crowdfunding? Because you raised $4.7 million
for Super
Troopers 2.
50,000 people gave us money. Because the studio was like, it's, you know, it's 17 years old or whatever it is. We don't think people want to go, so we're not going to put any money in. And, you know, in 30 days, we raised 4.7 and 50,000 people. And then the studio was like, we'll put it in. We'll pay the rest. Because they saw that there was a crowd.
And what was the rest?
Well, it's substantial, right? It was another 7.2, and then the advertising was another 10, right? So they put in 17.2.
Because isn't that, I love that, right? And that is the movie business, because it's, what's it called? Deficit financing.
Yeah.
So basically, like, a big studio will be like, well, if it's 10 million, you find the first five and then we'll give you five more. And I want to be like, if I had the first five, I wouldn't be here, my friend. I don't need you. Like, and that's a lot of it. Like, we'll get her to kiss you and then I'll kiss you too. And it's, I heard this, which is wild. There was a guy, you know, a lot of rich people will do, like, if there's an independent movie with a $1 to $3 million budget, for tax reasons, there are loopholes where a producer or someone with a lot of money can, like, hand over $2 million, figure out a way to write it off. As you know, they get their name on the back of a director's chair. I produced a movie and it's whatever. And their wife is excited to stand on set for a month. And I've heard that the way that they're presented movies is a one sheet, and it'll just be one page and it'll say, it's a Josh and Joe movie. Jay's directing it. Here's one paragraph about what the movie's about. Do you want to make it? And on that, they'll decide.
That is probably not totally true.
Really?
Yes, because I do it all the time. And it is a every bit a seduction that lasts for months. You know, and it starts with them seeing their friend who invested money with me, and I made them a lot of money, right? And that happened on Super Troopers 1 and 2. And they're like, well, this guy's at a party now talking about how he made money on a movie and he went to the premiere and he went to Sundance and he had his name on a chair. And they're kind of like, I want that too.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of rich people have put money into movies and lost money. And then they're right. Embarrassed because their friends are like, oh, you lost money. And they're making fun of them and all that, right? So You have to, like, put it out there that you're one of the filmmakers who makes money for people, and bring you to Sundance, and you want to come to the set, and, you know, and you kind of seduce them. I intend to make them money, and I will make them money, because if I don't, there, no one's going to invest in the next one.
Right.
You know, so I want to keep it, and you say stuff which is true, like, I'm going to keep it lean and mean, you know, and they hear that, they're like, all right, no wasted money, right? And it's true, yeah. Right? It's all true. We're going to keep it, we're going to make it for the minimum amount we need to make it. And I'm going to take a small salary, not a big one. And everyone's going to, you know, we're going to make it. And we're going to make money on the back end.
Yeah.
And it works.
Yeah.
It can work.
Can we do a quick improv?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to be Petey Pipes from New Jersey. Freehold, okay. New Jersey, right? Joe's hometown, uh-huh. Right? I got a couple mil, right? And I go, Jay, big fan of your movies. Super Troopers 2, unbelievable. Rarely sequels better than the first. It was better, nice. Okay? Thank Club you. Dread, Club best fucking movie I ever seen. I'm going to give you all the money you want. My daughter, she's a bit of an actress. I notice there's a nice-sized part. Some might call it the lead of your next film. I'd like my daughter, Isabella, to have an opportunity to audition, aka she gets the part, you don't get the money. Fuck you. All right? What's your thoughts?
I have a story here. Well, it's interesting because there was a producer in Hollywood when I was going around looking for Super Troopers too, and I'm sorry to break the improv. And so the guy was like, I'll give you $5 million for Super Troopers 2. All you got to do is put my Russian girlfriend in as the lead. And I'm like, I'll take the meeting. And so I'm at the Chateau Marmont, which is like a beautiful garden attached to one of the most ritziest, famous hotels in L.A., it's a place where I take meetings, right? I used to take meetings. And so I'm sitting there with this Russian actress who, by the way, was in the film Bobby because this guy financed Bobby. Like, mm-hmm. He's a real guy. And she played this fictitious Russian reporter character. And you're like, I mean, I'm a history major, and I just don't recall that character in the Kennedy saga. But there she is. She's kind of pivotal, this Russian woman, and they figured it out and put her in, and they took the money and made the movie, and I watched it in the theater. And then she's like, they wanted her to play the main part that Emmanuel Shrieky played, and you know, Emmanuel Shrieky is playing a French Canadian woman in this movie because
which she is,
yeah, she's in from Quebec, and you know, there you go. And I was like, And I met with her and we had lunch and whatever. And I went back to Broken Lizard. I'm like, here's the deal. We can get $5 million. And I'm pitching it. And I'm like, what if we made this character a Russian woman? And they're like, in Canada? And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, no, we're not doing that. I'm like, I know we're not doing it. I'm just telling you what happened. Of course, we're not doing it. And so I said, no, we're not doing it. But I mean, I thought about it, but even I knew it would never work. I mean, it would never work.
I find the most upsetting part of this story that you take your meetings at the Chateau Marmont. Who do you think you are, Jay? That is reserved for a specific type of meeting. No, I mean, it is the epitome of Hollywood.
Oh, very much.
Come on.
Very much. I've taken hundreds of meetings at the Chateau Marmont.
Stop it.
Hundreds.
Listen, if I get famous, I'm taking my meetings at like the LAX Denny's. Because I want to keep it humble, baby. Like, Chateau is the epitome. Oh, it just gives me a bad feeling walking into that place.
Our first meeting was Gus's Fried Chicken in Burbank.
Yeah.
Really?
Do it at a place like that. Where else would you do it besides there if you really wanted to see if an actor was down to clown?
I mean, when I'm making a movie, I roll into the Chateau at 9 a.m. and I sit there until about 3 p.m. and
this
one
is not
actor
helping your case.
After another comes in. And I have coffee with them, and sometimes I'm eating, and I'm writing a script or whatever, and they come in, and then I just chat with them.
Oh, I've been, speaking as the one on the other side of that, uh-huh. Jay, as you're like there, and your meeting's at 3, and I'm there at 2:45, you know, Petey Punctual over uh-huh. here, and Miles Teller's having coffee with you, and I'm like, why am I here? Why am I here? Oh, it's the worst.
I try to build a buffer in to avoid that, but it does happen. It does happen.
Oh, trust me.
And particularly when I was interviewing women for Daisy Duke, it was like one famous woman in jean shorts after another rolling into the Chateau Marmont. And sometimes they overlap, and I was like, oh, sorry. That's tough.
Is there anything in an audition other than being unprepared that turns you off, like someone who's dressed as the character for an audition?
You know, it didn't bother me that they were dressed in the jean shorts, and in fact I appreciated it.
Yeah.
I thought it was helpful. Because you know, the shorts were almost the whole character. And then of course you have to act, but if you don't have the shorts working first, then you're not going to, that's not the right. And to be able to see it, you go, yeah, okay, sure.
Right.
But I've had people who auditioned for Beer Fest for like the German team show up in full Lederhosen and things. And I hired one of them. I think it's important for actors to kind of at least look the part.
Oh, yeah.
To try to, I mean, you know, within reason, but you have to have the guts to show up in Lederhosen.
I think so too. And speaking, you know, I would say my ego for a long time would not allow me to dress as the character. I'd just be like, fuck that. Because I didn't want to look sweaty. I didn't want to look like I needed it or wanted it that much.
It's a fine line.
But now I care so much about just doing my best as an actor and honoring the material that I'm like, I don't give a fuck. And I'll always like I'm not gonna wear like a full 3-piece suit, but I might wear like if I'm a lawyer, a button up.
Me too.
And just maybe a jacket.
Yeah.
Just like because I'm like this is gonna help me act better.
Yeah.
Regardless, because like I won't feel this official if I'm in a t-shirt and jeans.
That's right. And right? And the other thing you can do, which is what all the British actors do, is show up off book.
Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, a lot of people will walk in there with the page and they'll just kind of read it, and you're like. I mean, you see the British guy who just came in here? I mean, my God. They prep more.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's also valuable. I mean, it's, you know, you can hold it, but it's nice to have them off book.
Well, they still think they're a superpower, Britain. But, you know, not for some time. Hey, so do we hate Rotten Tomatoes?
Okay. You know what happened? It's now 20 years ago. Super Troopers came out, Sundance, with 3 midnight screenings. Everyone was like high and drunk at the screenings. And they were incredible. They were really sophisticated film goers, but they were, you know, they were out late and they went to the late movie. And the screenings were so overwhelming and incredible. They were, I mean, I cried in the first one. There was such joy and release of tension. And then Fox Searchlight bought it for $3.25 million. We made the film for $1.2 million. Everything was great. A whole year, we did reshoots, we recut it. Then the film comes out in, I think, February. And it gets a 36% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes from, I think it's like 90 reviewers, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, you just Sundance and the whole, you missed the whole. I mean, people in Sundance think it's cool, and you guys, what? And I'm like, eventually... 250,000 people watched the film on, and they rated it 90% fresh, right? The citizens. And I was like, it just stuck in my craw, these 90 people. I'm like, who are these reviewers? Like, who are they? Like, they're just strangers with jobs where they get to trash movies, right? Or love movies, right? And I'm like, they're strangers. Like, when's the last time you walked up to a stranger and said, hey, what movie should I see? Right. That's what we're doing with reviewers, right? And even worse with Rotten Tomatoes, nobody even reads the reviews anymore. It's just this number of official people who get to decide what a movie opens. And I talked to a reviewer about it once. They're like, what are you? Come on, you make comedies. You guys make tons of money. And I'm like, we make less money because you give these dumb reviews. And the reason you attack us is so that you can get more followers because it's fun to attack stuff, right? And people, you're good writers, and you make fun of us, and it's funny. I've read these funny reviews at our expense, and they're like, yeah. And but I know the real story is they can't attack Spielberg because they want to go to the Oscar parties, right?
Sure.
But they can attack us because we're the clowns, right? Or the horror guys. They can, you know. But it's hard to make a comedy. Anyway, regardless, I decided then 20 years ago that I was going to figure out a way to get revenge. And I've been stewing on it for 16 years. And then I started outlining an app, a machine, a revenge machine to basically supplant Rotten Tomatoes. And to be clear, I have no problem with reviewers. I respect them. I like that they like movies. But when you group them all together and put a number on it, I have a problem with that. Rotten Tomatoes is named for throwing rotten fruit at filmmakers. Mm. It's right there in the title, right? So I built... what I wanted was I built a machine. It's an app, right? It's called Vouch Vault. And me and this guy, Eli Saz and Eric Colbert, they're computer guys. We built this app, which is basically Instagram for recommendations. Okay, so if you follow me, you'll see I like Turner and Hooch. I like Goodfellas. I like, you know, The Godfather. I like the Van Morrison album. I like Osteria La Buca, the restaurant in Hollywood. I like the W Hotel in New York. You know, whatever I like, right? And it's podcasts, it's music, it's everything. And so you come to my page and you go, oh, he likes this, he likes that, he likes that. And if you haven't seen it before, you just click a ribbon and it'll go into your Tri Vault, right? So like when you're at a dinner party and some friend goes, hey, there's this great sitcom on BBC Three, and you write it on some napkin or you put it into your phone. Instead, you just put it into my app in your Tri-Vault. And so on Friday, when you're like, what should we watch, babe? You look in your Tri-Vault. You go, oh, I got 10 things here. Jay said this was good. Boom. Click a link, and there you go. And so it's you know, like some people have described it like, oh, it's only positive. I'm like, yeah, because when's the last time you went to a dinner party and said, hey, what sucks? What shouldn't I see? It's not how we behave, but this is how we're oriented. And instead you go, what's great? And you go, well, you know, I vouched for all these things. This, you should listen to this album and you should see this movie and you should, you know,
right,
and listen to this podcast. And then it's all right there. It's all sitting there forever. It's, and it's all, the other thing for me is that we don't have DVDs. We don't have CDs. We don't barely have records. Right. So when my kids are like, what's good? What music is good from the 90s or 80s? I'm like, well, you know, you should listen to whatever. Oingo Boingo. I didn't really like them. But anyway, you mention a band, and then there's that thing where do they look it up or do they not? Do they write it down? Or probably not, right? But instead, I've tried to create this memory machine, right? So now there are no DVDs sitting around in the TV room. So they're like, they only see what Netflix sends them, right? But instead, they can look in my vouch file and go, oh, Dog Day Afternoon. Dad says it's one of the greatest movies of all time. Okay, boom. So it's there, you know? Right. It's always there.
I'm trying to think of what would be on my page. It'd be hot chicken, hiking.
Wrestling.
Wrestling. Yes, WWE, the 90s years.
Attitude Era.
Attitude Era, obviously. Joe, yours?
Anything with The Rock.
The new Kardashians on Hulu.
All reality TV, Jersey Shore.
Yeah, but yes. You know, then we know, okay, that's what he likes. So then when a new reality show comes out, I go, well, this guy's an expert on reality because he loves all these things.
Yeah.
You know, or he's an expert on wrestling. Okay, this wrestling thing, he says it's good. Okay, good, you know.
Well, you know, you brought up Turner and Hooch, not me. We got fucking killed on Rotten Tomatoes. Like, I mean, we didn't get killed per se, but we were like right hovering in between 50 and 60%. But on Rotten Tomatoes, that's killed. And it was people whose reviews were, by the way, similarly, the people, the normal, loved it.
Yeah.
You know, the big stupid dog, big stupid yeah. me, perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? But the reviews were all these schmucks being like, Josh Peck is no Tom Hanks, which I wanted to reply, duh. Like, and also, like, this is so clearly not that. Did the marketing department make an exact replica of the original movie poster with my face on it? Yes. Did I think that was a mistake? Mm-hmm. But you're right. Like, we couldn't fight it. It felt unfair.
Well, you got to remember, like, Turner and Hooch is made for a certain audience, right? And that audience, I mean, it's like, why is like a 50-year-old intellectual reviewing Turner and Hooch?
Sure.
The reason is because their boss at the newspaper said, hey, you got to review Turner and Hooch. And you're like, well, that's inorganic, right? Like, the only reason I would see Turner and Hooch would be if I wanted to see Turner and Hooch. Mm-hmm. And then it shows my interest in it. And then I go, is it a good execution of this dog cop thing or not?
Right.
That's, I mean, the guy who didn't like Super Troopers at the New York Times also, he didn't really love The Hangover. And I'm like, okay, so maybe you don't like R-rated comedies.
Right.
And so what are you doing reviewing an R-rated comedy?
Right.
And on his vouch vault, I bet he has zero R-rated comedies because he doesn't like them very much.
I'll tell you what, he's not fucking allowed on vouch vault. That's why.
Well, you know, I think reviewers, I can imagine a thing where you've followed a reviewer and it was just the stuff they loved.
Right.
And it's this French Truffaut film and it's a Brazilian. And you go, wow, this is great. What did it, well, either they see so many movies and now I know what they love.
Right. Well, and also the bandwidth of professional reviewers is only so much, right? Like, we follow people on Instagram that we think are cool and they're curating this life of like, oh, they go to these cool restaurants and what have you. And you're like, yeah, but this person could never go work for the Washington Post because only they have two reviewers.
Yeah.
And but by me following them, I get to know what they find dope, which I will probably think is cool too. So it's access, right?
Yeah. And it's, you know, if you start to realize that, like, you know, you and I, Josh, we have overlap on 20 things. And so when I'm like, hey, there's this new Swedish murder movie, you'll be like, well, we do agree on these other 20 things. I'll give it a try. You know, we're going to start to have overlapping senses of taste. You know, so then the reviewer, I won't be a stranger to you. You'll be like, well, we agree on all this. That's why I'm listening to what he says. As opposed to somebody in the New York Times going, I got assigned Super Troopers 3 and I don't like these kind of movies, but here's my review.
Now, not that we need to harp on bad reviews here, but once a reviewer said about a performance of mine in a movie that it looked as though I was mentally challenged. Guys, any thoughts?
I love you. I love that you told us that. And look how much glee we're getting out of it. I'm getting glee out of somebody calling you mentally challenged. And that is what that's why they do it.
Right.
We spend years trying to make these movies.
That's right.
And those writers, they whip that off in an hour? And that's okay. They're entitled to their opinion. But I just want to hear what they love. I don't want to hear what they hate, because they would never mention that at a dinner party.
Well, now in the age of clickbait and thumbnails, it's like they need a headline, ultra positive or ultra bad, because something in the middle is not going to get clicked. But also, and to your point, like there are certain reviewers who I follow. Like I find I'm sadly one of those people where I'm like, reviewers to me, not, I would say 75% of the time I'm like, yeah, I probably agree.
Uh-huh.
But there's no bravery in critique. There's bravery in creating.
That's
and
right.
And I think we have to be cognizant of that when we're being critical.
I think that's super true. But I do get it. Like I understand that we're the show offs, right? Like we put on the makeup and the wardrobe and the lights and we say the jokes and we're quippy, and of course we want people to respond.
Right.
And so when they respond, we can't be too hurt when they call us mentally challenged. However, again,
highly functioning,
you know,
maybe just on the spectrum. I mean, Asperger's, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. But
Elon Musk has it.
It's not a machine just for me to get positive reviews. I know that reviewers have historically not been my biggest fans. I get it. They're going to continue probably not being my biggest fans, especially now that I've built a machine to take them down. But I just want to know what reviewers love. Because they do watch a lot of movies.
Imagine Andreessen Horowitz, some big, big VC comes in. They go, Jay, love the app. Love what you're doing here. Want to buy it? Nice. Couple hundred mil. But we're going to need a negative side of the app. You build that?
No.
Oh, yes, you do. No. Oh, yeah.
No.
I'll pass on the 300 million. Yeah, right.
Well, wait a minute. If we're going to make up fictitious situations, I can't have a fictitious no here, too?
Well, where can... Is the app on the app? Like, where can people get it?
On the Apple Store and the Android Store. It's, you know... I mean, it's early days, but, you know, we got a couple thousand people going.
I love it.
And I'm trying to get people like you guys to do it, and then I want to tell the press, hey, we got Josh Peck.
Yeah.
So, and then I'll you know who's in charge of verifying? This guy. I can get you the check mark.
I'm downloading it right now.
Boom.
Wow. Well, boom. Listen, Joe and I are happy to be involved. We will need some sort of small fee. We are influencers. We don't do this for fun. And when's your new movie come out?
I have a movie that people are going to review. This is the danger of what I'm doing, but whatever. I mean, it can't get any worse. Here's what happened. I was sitting at home during the pandemic, you know, playing golf every day, and my phone rings and they say, do you know who Joe Coy is? And I'm like, yeah, he's a comic. He's, you know, Filipino American guy. You know, he's funny. Really, I've seen him on Netflix. He goes, okay. So Steven Spielberg saw one of Joe Coy's specials on Netflix during the pandemic, and he said, we got to make a movie with that guy. So the window is May and June in Vancouver. Can you go to Vancouver in 3 weeks and make that movie for us? And I was like, yeah, okay. And Joe Coy, if you don't know him, is the biggest ticket selling comic in show business.
It's insane.
58,000 seats in Los Angeles over three nights.
The Forum, right?
At the
three
Forum.
Three nights in a row.
Yeah, 38,000 in Seattle. He sells out basketball stadiums, right?
Wow.
And he's a really funny dude.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, and I opened for him in Nashville and Florida, and it's like, I mean, he's one of those guys, he did 2.5 hours. And I'm like, and he before he went up, he goes, I got 5 jokes written. I'm like, okay. And they love him so much, it's almost religious. Like, and so, you know, I got to direct his first film, and the movie turned out really, really well. And it's coming out August 5th, theatrically wide. And to give you a sense of how crazy this business is at this moment, we're the only wide release theatrical comedy this summer.
No way.
Yes. It's stunning.
Wow.
So much has gone to streaming and, you know, straight to video and all that stuff. They hate when I say straight to video. But that's what it is. Anyway. But they, you know, they became afraid of releasing theatrical movies. And I said to Universal, I said, we got the number one ticket selling comic in the business. We have a movie that audiences really dig. And you're Universal. You guys are you guys released Knocked Up and the 40-year-old. You guys are the machine that is the best releasing machine of comedies in show business. I'm like, it's like having Steve Martin before The Jerk, or it's like having Eddie Murphy before 48 Hours. Like, we got that. If we can't release this thing theatrically, let's just fold it up. And they fell for that speech, and they said, let's do it. And I look, they know, they didn't really fall for it. They knew what I was saying, and they also right. knew what they got. And they're like, let's go for it. So we're going to release it theatrically August 5th.
3,000 screens?
Oh, yeah, it's wide.
Baby, well, you know, wide could be 2,500, could be 4,000.
You're right. The definition of wide is set by Searchlight. Hey. is 1800 can be wide at Searchlight, but this is a universal wide,
this
buddy.
Is Spielberg. Spielberg hanging out, Spielberg talking, Spielberg on emails.
Spielberg would send me notes. I have yet to meet him because of COVID. Like, our editing rooms are supposed to be in the same spot. He's editing a movie. But you know, during COVID, you got to be careful who you eat. I mean, you couldn't, you know, to go into Amblin, you have to be triple tested, and he wasn't even there. But he would send me notes, like on the first night, Joe Coy wanted to wear a hat, and because it made him feel comfortable, the first time he'd ever acted really in a movie, and so he's wearing this Dodger hat, and I get a note the second day which says movie stars don't wear hats. And I'm like, get the hat off. What are you doing with that hat? Can you take the hat off, pal?
That's because you guys had filmed for one day. Then Steven had watched what's called dailies.
Yeah.
So he had watched everything you had shot the day before. And that was his note.
Yeah. He said, great job. This guy can act. But movie stars don't wear hats.
Fascinating.
And I said, okay, fine. I mean, you know, he did make Raiders of the Lost Ark. I didn't respond with that, but I just said, yes, sir.
Mm.
And we took the hat off. But, you know.
There's got to be very few things that you're really going to go to the mat for against Steven Spielberg. Not that you'd even come into that because he's so great.
I would over a creative issue, right? And you know, we were casting an actress to play somebody very big in the movie. And I had a deal with Warner Brothers for years, and they're like, just cast the most famous person and then you teach them how to act. Isn't that your job? And I'm like, okay, fine. So I would do that. I would cast the most famous person who wanted to do the role, and then I'd make sure they could act. And I'm getting ready to cast this woman, and I send him my choices, you know, this most famous person, and then two others. And he goes, I don't know. Shouldn't we hire that one, the third one? And I'm like, well, I said, yeah, she's the best actress, but she's not, I mean, this one's world famous. And he goes, why wouldn't you hire the best actress? And I'm like, yeah, exactly. You're right.
Right, because he can do that.
Yes. And so I said, okay, we'll hire the best actress. He goes, oh, that's probably a good choice. And it turns out to be the most important casting decision of the movie. And I had to retrain myself to do that. And it was so nice to have a person of that power go, what are you doing? Make the best movie. And I'm like, yes, sir. Yes, right. And get your hat off, everybody. What are you doing?
It's so funny. I once did a 3D dance movie with a Mr. Chris Brown. I don't mean to brag. It was a It was a dry life. It was a dry year. And so I'm in France, and it was this, you know, the old president of Screen Gems.
I know him.
And so I and so he happened to be on set, and I remember that he, you know, it's about B-boys and break dancers, and so specifically for those kind of dancers, like, so much of the attitude and the dress and the accessories is a part of who they are. And so of course they're all wearing hats and different outfits, and Chris Brown's wearing a hat, and the head of Screen Gems goes up to Chris Brown and takes his hat off, like, without asking, and says, "I don't want anything to cover that movie star face of yours." And Chris did not take kindly to someone removing his hat. Now, in his defense, you don't touch someone's hat. Not never. Even if you're me, you know, chubby Jew actor kid. You know, you don't touch my hat. You definitely don't touch Chris Brown's hat. And it was an explosive few minutes on set in reaction to just Chris basically making it very clear that no one is to touch any of Mr. Brown's accessories.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, did he not know who was in charge? Or he didn't care?
Oh, he didn't care.
Yeah.
It was an interesting, but it was also such a...
It's so intrusive.
You don't take off someone's hat.
No, no.
I will, and I don't think I'm talking out of school here, and this is to Chris's, I think, I respect this about Chris, is that it was the first day he was on set. We had been filming in France for like a month, and he shows up for one day of filming. And it's this massive dance, like this insane dance scene. And I'll never forget that some of the B-boys would tell me, like, here's the thing, like, there are great dancers, but very few people can do what we do because it's acrobatic. There's like this extra level of like just physical, like it, there's just a, you have to almost be like a gymnast in addition to a great dancer. And so I knew Chris was a great dancer, but I'm like, does he possess this extra skill? He gets on set and he blows the doors off the place like I've never seen. Like the level of, I'm like, this is Sammy Davis Jr. Like this is unlike anything I've ever seen before. And it's a 3D movie, because of course. And Chris
in
is,
France.
In France. Because
of course.
Because of course. Sony, heard of it. And Chris is doing this incredible sort of back double handspring towards the camera, and it's going to look really cool. And he does it once, and he kind of bumps the camera right in the landing. And they go, moving on, great, let's go. And Chris goes, no, 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 I need another one. Like, I bumped the camera. And they go, trust us, it's great, Chris. And they move on. And he goes, trust me, I'll never do a bit of press for this movie unless I get another take. And they were like, no problem, Mr. Brown. And I'm like, yeah. Like, you give the guy who just did a triple backspring, who's the most charming thing you've ever seen, who wants to make it better, you give him one.
Yes, of course you right. give him one.
Right.
I mean, when I finish a take with an actor, I say, are you happy? And they go, well, if you're happy, I'm like, it's up to you. If you want to move on, we'll move on. If you want another take, we'll do another take. And it relaxes people, and it makes them be great, because they're like, they have a sense that if they want to take, they got to take. What's the problem?
What if you're on a TV set and you're, you know, you're hitting the 12-hour mark, they're going to put the plug, and that actor's like, I want another take, and you in your head go, it's not going to get any better.
Well, here's the thing about film and television. I'm about to lay it down. The reality is, if you shoot the scene and you don't finish the scene, at some point in your lives, you're going to finish the scene. And sorry, we're going to do another take and we're going to go over.
But what if you know it's not going to, like, what if you're like, it's going to just be fine?
It's about it's human management, better. Right? It's about what the actor feels. And my ability to really manipulate actors is based on the fact that they believe that I am watching them and that I'll give them a chance to be great artists. And I say manipulate because that's what directors do. We're constantly manipulating people. And I'm benevolently manipulating them in this case, but I'm trying to get the greatest thing out of their performance. And if they believe that they get to show me how great they can be, then they're going to be better. Right. And so I say, yeah, you've done the same thing the last 7 takes in a row, but okay, let's have an 8th. I won't say that. I'll be like, show me. Let's do it. Do whatever you want, because what I have already is great. And often that eighth take will be something special.
Because they're free.
Yes.
I'll tell you this is a story I've heard about from, and we'll close with this, very famous director. Extreme. One of the most. I heard he once gave this note to an actor in an audition, did a couple takes, and then he goes, okay, let's try it one more time and do it the way you'd do it if you were driving home right now knowing you blew it.
I love that.
Is that a fucking great note?
I love that. Can I use that?
Sure.
I'm going to.
Jay, thank you for doing the pod.
It was so fun. My man. Oh, did I tell you my movie's called Easter Sunday?
Joe Coy.
Yes.
August
5th.
Wide.
Wide. You know, sign up for Vouch Vault and then vouch for Easter Sunday.
It's going to be linked in the description too, so check it out.
And to the reviewer who called me mentally challenged, maybe at a point.